and welcome to another week of Small Biz Matters, People, Policy, Purpose. And today's episode, we're talking to someone who represents a group of boffins who wield influence and power in Canberra and across state and local governments too. And it's just as well, since they do know the effect of policy on politics, on business and the economy as a whole. But the big question is, how well do they understand and reflect the needs of small business in their research and policy work? We are, after all, the backbone of the economy. We welcome today to the show Stephen, who, as a previous chief economist for New South Wales Treasury and chief economist with the Australian Institute of Company Directors, AICD, and JP Morgan, he is now the chief economist for the Business Council of Australia. He's passionate about ensuring all stakeholders in the economy have a better knowledge of how macroeconomics shapes the real world we all live in and that which small businesses thrive. And he's going to share all of his knowledge and wisdom with us today.
Welcome to Small Biz Matters, a show where we are dedicated to empowering small businesses and advisors to engage with policy and advocacy. Why? Because what government does very much matters to all small biz, good and bad. Sponsored by the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman's Office, each week we sit down with experts, advocates, business leaders, policymakers, and politicians to dive into specific areas of government policy that affects your clients and your business. We'll give you the heads up on what's coming down the policy pipeline, find out who's fighting in your corner, and empower you with ways you can influence those decisions which affect your business every single day. We proudly broadcast live on our local community radio station, Triple H 100.1 FM, the Community Broadcasting Network, and later wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Let's hear from this week's expert on Small Biz Matters. People, policy, purpose.
And welcome to the studios of Triple H 100.1 FM. You are listening live and we're very pleased to have a guest live in the studio today, Stephen Walters, who is here from the Business Council of Australia. I would say the most powerful business lobby group, possibly not the most important, but I might be a little bit more biased. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you, Alexia. It's great to be here.
Now, we've known each other for a number of years and importantly, I came across you with someone who was quite passionate about the role of economists and economics in driving policy when we went through the washing machine that was COVID-19. You, at the time, were part of New South Wales Treasury. Tell me why it is that you're so passionate about making sure that small businesses are included in those discussions about economics and policy making.
Oh, thank you, Alexia. Yeah, that was an extraordinary time. I was chief economist to the state during that pandemic, and it was my role sort of to balance the health advice that the chief health officer was giving to government and cabinet and communicating. You saw all those daily press conferences that Paul Carey had to do on television and say what's happening with the pandemic. I was sort of behind the scenes to a much bigger extent, but hopefully influencing what government was doing. And I was very conscious of making sure, as you said, that small business could still operate. We all remember what COVID was like. I bet we don't want to go into too much detail about how
it might be a bit triggering.
Indeed, for a lot of people. But I did recognise that small business was particularly badly affected because the restrictions were so extended and they were pretty profound. We all locked in our bedrooms and our front rooms and trying to work and study. I had a daughter going through HSC that period, and our own work was all confined to quarters. So I really understood, I think, I haven't worked in small business, but I think I have a pretty good understanding of how small business works. Mm. You said I'm with the Business Council now. I mean, that's the polar opposite end. I now represent, or my organisation represents, the so-called big end of town. Mm. Qantas, BHP, the banks, all the industrial companies, effectively the listed companies that are in Australia, and also a lot of big companies overseas that have operations in Australia. So Amazon, Google, Boeing, household names around the world, they're BCA members as well. But I reckon we do have a pretty good insight as to how the business community more broadly, there's a lot of medium-sized business, there's huge businesses, and there's a lot of small businesses. And they're very diverse, as you well know. Some are really just one or two people, might be a family. Others are a little bit bigger. They employ people. They might have family working in those businesses. But I reckon I had a pretty good understanding that I hopefully communicated to government decision makers that small business gets affected in much the same way as big business, that is probably didn't have as loud a voice at the time.
That's exactly right. I mean, and that's mainly the problem with understanding, and this is what this program is all about, is explaining to people who represents them and how they do that and the mechanics of that, so that people can feel a little bit more, I guess, comfortable in the idea that there are people representing them in the echelons of power, literally walking the halls alongside politicians. Now, I wanted to ask you about that work that you did with New South Wales Treasury. You mentioned that you were behind the scenes. Is it literally just a matter of crunching some numbers on a spreadsheet and then sort of explaining what that means in a practical sense to those who are making decisions? I mean, Kerry Chant was the head of, the chief medical officer for I nearly said Australia there.
She would like to have been, maybe.
But she was a chief medical officer. But what I appreciated about New South Wales government was that everybody worked hand in hand. You had economists from New South Wales Treasury, you had the health department, you had customer service, all working in what I consider to be the gold standard where we compare it to other states. But what exactly did you do in a practical sense, you know, on a daily basis when you were advising at that point?
So my role was quite unique in that no other state or territory had a chief economist, quite interestingly. So yeah, it's a bit weird. Mine was a new role. So Mike Pratt, who was running Treasury at the time, who you know well, and Dom Perrottet was Treasurer at the time, they decided that the economics profession was not represented in the way it should have been across government.
I find that astounding.
Yeah,
I mean, that to me
was.
I assumed with the work that we did together that that economists are embedded. I mean, I know that there
are
people with economy degrees that they do that work, but having a chief economist, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it was a new role. So don't get me wrong, there's hundreds and hundreds of economists across the state government and in federal government. They didn't have the role of chief economist. The role was supposed to be sort of outreach and of course, the pandemic came along unexpectedly. We didn't know that was coming. So I'd been there about 8 months when the pandemic hit. So I think it was fortuitous that, I would say this, that the state government had a chief economist to try to influence in cabinet, to communicate outside government, not just on the pandemic, but on the performance of the state economy, our challenges, how to get productivity to improve, labour force participation to improve, the planning system to get more houses approved. So my role sort of spanned right across all government policy, across different departments, across different portfolios. I engaged with different ministers. But it was really during the pandemic that I think the role came into its own. And I got to say, Kerry and I were really able to work, when I say behind the scenes, we'd have conversations, not quite every day, but at the worst of the pandemic and lockdown periods, we would have conversations multiple times a day. And we'd test sort of like, well, if the government was to do this and restrict activities in, say, retail, so you couldn't go out to your local supermarket except at certain hours, you couldn't go into the city and go shopping down Pitt Street Mall, my job and my team's job was to work out, well, what's the economic cost of that?
Mm. And that, I guess, would require quite a lot of research. Were you relying on, I mean, this is a difficulty of working in such a unique period of time, were you relying on former data? I mean, you couldn't really compare it with another pandemic that we'd recently had.
No.
So how did you get those figures and that data to be able to, I guess, prove what your theories were around what a lockdown impact would have?
Well, one of the constraints I should mention is time. So often we'd hear about this like at a cabinet meeting or from a cabinet meeting that I may not have been at, and the decision would be implemented that day and start from like 7 a.m. the next morning. So we didn't have the luxury of like going through enormous amounts of research, or we used what we could.
Mm-hmm.
We used economic data.
But what made you unique, which is, this is where I was, and I'm proud to say that New South Wales was the gold standard because of this engagement piece. And this is what I think that New South Wales did well, was engaging with, in particular, business groups at various levels, those who had different requirements and different needs, and being respectful of what the feedback was that you were getting. And we did move mountains. Sometimes decisions were, I won't say backflipped, but they were adjusted, or the timing might have been adjusted because they were listening to the business community. Is that maybe the difference with what this particular role of being a chief economist was, that you had that engagement and, as you said, that outreach?
I think so. That I was certainly part of that. I don't want to take credit for New South Wales, I think, being the gold standard, but I think the fact that we had really open communication. I remember we had communication with COSBOA, representing the small business lobby. We had communication with the Big Business Council of Australia, whom I happen to work for now, and various other chambers of commerce and Australian Industry Group and others about, okay, what would happen if we shut down Western Sydney, which did happen? What happens to food distribution across Sydney? Mm. Well, we knew the outcome pretty quickly would be pretty catastrophic. Forget about toilet paper. You wouldn't be able to get meat or bread or milk. So, yeah, those decisions were really responsive. Mm. And I think that was the real advantage of New South Wales. And I won't name other states who didn't do this as well. I think we all know who they might be.
you people know who you are.
Yeah, indeed. But I think we had really open communication and engagement with right from smaller businesses right through to the big listed part of our economy, the big listed companies. We got feedback instantly.
Yep.
And I think the Premier and the Treasurer, to their great credit, and other ministers, had an open communication line.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So if a government made a decision that was going to have a really cascading impact right through down to smaller businesses, they get feedback pretty quickly that, hey, do you realise that you've done this? And if they wanted to stick with that decision, which was a decision for executive government, that's when my team, and to their great credit, they would do our best over, say, a 4 or 5 hour period to work out what that cost may be. And at least that could be then fed into, along with the health advice and the police advice and all the other advice they were getting from different parts of government, as to, okay, if we do this on health grounds, this is going to be the economic implications from that.
Yeah, I bet you didn't have a right to disconnect, though. You would have been working some pretty crazy hours.
It was a pretty intensive period. But look, people clearly had a much worse experience than me during the pandemic.
Absolutely.
But no, indeed, it was a busy... I don't think we had a weekend off for probably 9 months there.
Wow. So this is a really good example of where economists can use their influence and power for good. And as you mentioned, there are economists throughout all government departments. So it's one of the important, I guess, mechanisms of government to understand what the economic impacts will be. So they wield a lot of influence. They can help the government to make decisions. Tell me about really basically what the process is of, say, someone who's an economist within the Department of Employment Workplace Relations. What would that role ensue, just to explain to the listeners?
So, yeah, there are economists pretty much in all walks of life. Every cab driver thinks they're an economist, of course, but some of them are. But, look, a lot of people have economics degrees but don't work as economists. I had the good fortune of doing an economics degree as soon as I left school. I went on and did postgraduate qualifications a bit later, but started out in government. So I started out in Treasury, which is sort of the go-to for an economist. The Reserve Bank is one of the others. And as you mentioned, in, say, the employment workplace relations area, there'd be a lot of economists in there examining, for example, what if the government did a certain policy change on workplace relations, which clearly they've been doing over the last 18 months or so, they'd be looking at, okay, what's going to happen to, for example, wages, and they'd make predictions on based on history. So economics is very data-driven, as most people probably realise. It's why a lot of people think it's pretty dull and a pretty boring subject. And we can talk about that. In fact, economics studies at university are in freefall.
And at schools. I think I was reading the
schools
statistic.
Terrible.
One in two public schools offer economics. Thank goodness my daughter is studying economics in year 11, which is it's really important. I mean, that's a bit scary. If you're telling me that they have so much important influence and they're part of the mechanics of government, if we've got a free fall going on.
Indeed, particularly among young women.
Mm.
So it's seen as a bit mathematical, a bit boring and a bit of a male-dominated space. Like when you see economists, we call them talking heads, I used to be one of them, pop up on television, almost invariably it's men, middle-aged blokes. I'm a middle-aged bloke, but a lot of them look like me. So it's not a particularly good role model for young women to think that's what I want to do.
That's a good point.
There are some really prominent female economists who I know really well. They're friends. They're on television too. So it's changing. But imagine if we woke up in a couple of years' time and there were no economists. Can you imagine the chaos there'd be in the, not just in government, but in the banks?
Mm.
A lot of economists work in the banks. I spent a lot of my career working in investment banking as an economist. That's a completely different sort of very short-term decision-making, thinking about what's going to happen in markets and interest rates and equity markets and the like and economic data. But back in the government context, it's a little slower pace, but a lot more analytical about looking at here's the data, here's the problem we might be trying to solve, and here, using that data and making assumptions, we always make assumptions in economics, we get mocked for that in some quarters, but it's actually about making informed analysis and decisions that can actually say, right, if we do this, given this, and based on the data of history and our predictions and our models, we always use models, then you can actually say, well, here's the likely outcome from that, and you as a decision maker, whether it's in banking or in government or politicians, can actually use that information to hopefully say, well, on that basis, we think it's worth doing because it might lift female participation in the workforce. That's a great outcome. It might do something else that's less advantageous to the economy, so at least they know that when they're making the decision.
You mentioned a lot about data and the importance of understanding, unpacking it and predicting it, a bit like a weatherman, really. I thought of the Bureau of Meteorology as you were talking there. But what concerns me is that there isn't a lot of data on small business, because quite often we are difficult to wrangle or it's hard to predict what a small business in a particular sector might be doing or how they behave because the data isn't there. And I know that it's a major problem. How much is it seen as a big problem within government departments and for economists more broadly that you just don't have a handle on what's going on in the small business economy? Is it a concern?
It is a concern. And I'm mindful too of there's an issue called respondent burden, which for big business is less of a problem because they've probably got a compliance department, they might have a tax department, they might have an HR department. It's a lot easier to fill out forms, even electronically. It's much harder for small business. So I think that's one problem. Small business, as you know, is very good at doing what their business is, maybe less sort of able to spend all night filling out forms because they don't have the compliance department or the legal department.
And I know that the ABS is trying to resolve this by working with organisations like Xero to gather that data automatically. You just need to tick a box that says I'm happy for the ABS to be extracting my data and there's some good governance there around keeping that data secure.
Yeah.
But if the ABS does come knocking, a small business must complete whatever it is they've been asked to do.
Yeah.
Yes, that burden is there, but in my mind, and what I encourage my listeners to do, is to take part in those surveys, because without that information, the government is flying blind with policy. Would you agree with that?
That's a really good point, and it is a big gap. Economists recognise it as a big gap, but as you said, the ABS is getting a lot better, and I think as we evolve and use our phones for so much more, there's our credit cards, the banks are now providing to the ABS a lot of the data that comes through our credit cards. Often that's for the big supermarkets, which is not small business. But of course, if I use my credit card today at a small cafe buying lunch, that's registered with the bank.
No, I'm going to dispute that, because in a lot of cases, if you're going to a sushi joint or you're going to a cafe, it doesn't say that on the bank statement or the bank feed lines or the CSV. That information is not necessarily there. I'll give you an example. My hairdresser is not called Bob Hairdresser. He's called Vifam. And that has nothing to do with the name of
the company name.
Exactly.
So look, very hard to identify what the spending is. You know the spending. You know you spent, I mean, I probably spent $20. You might have spent $900. I don't know.
A bit more than 20
at the
bucks.
Hairdresser. But no, I take your point. But at least we know that spending was made. There's another problem then of identifying, well, was it a hairdresser or was it my lunch? Mm. Yeah, very, very hard. I get it. ABS is trying to address that. They've got funding pressures themselves. Government's been cutting their funding for a decade or so or more. So it is a problem, but we're getting better.
Yep.
But the old way of when I first started out in this business a long time ago of respondents having to fill out paper forms, we've come a mile from that and we're actually using a lot more data provided by typically the big businesses, but increasingly smaller business as well is starting to fill that gap. But you've got a long way to go.
Yeah, indeed. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you about which macroeconomic factors in your mind most influence an impact on small businesses on a day-to-day basis when they're trying to run their business. You're listening to Triple H 100.1 FM. We'll be back after this.
This episode of Small Biz Matters is proudly sponsored by the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman's Office. ASBIFIO assists, advocates and provides information to Australia's 2.5 million small and family businesses when and where they need it. ASBIFIO delivers practical and actionable advice and research to governments on how to improve policies and legislation. Since its inception, ASBIFIO has responded to over 40,000 requests for assistance from Australian small and family businesses and provides access to dispute resolution services, including assistance with disputes that fall under the franchising, dairy, horticulture and oil codes. ASBIFIO also connects small and family business with mental health support should the need arise. As an independent advocate for small business owners, ASBIFIO is committed to ensuring that Australia is the best place to start, grow or transform a business now and well into the future. See how ASBIFIO can support you at asbfeo.gov.au.
So we're back in the studio of Triple H 100.1 FM. We've been speaking to Stephen Walters, who is the chief economist at Business Council of Australia, formerly with New South Wales Treasury. And just before the break, we were talking a lot about what impact economists have on small businesses. But I wanted to ask you, in your mind, macroeconomically, which are the most impactful pieces of data that small businesses should be keeping an eye on? They can't see everything. They can't be aware of everything. But there's times during the news cycle where you only hear about the unemployment rate, or you only hear about interest rates or inflation. What should small businesses keep an eye on to really understand and unpack how economics affects their business?
It's a really good question, Alexi, and I think many small business operators have the disadvantage, and I would say this, of not having access to economists. Big end of town, like the banks and the big listed companies, they get access to a lot of economists so they can ask these sort of questions. Smaller business has to rely on news flow or their own reading or their own reading of the press, and that's a good start. But there's a whole range of economic data that you don't hear about. And almost every day, there's probably at least one, if not two, major economic releases that come out from the ABS. So I'd urge people who are running businesses, if they have time, keep an eye on the ABS. And it might be stuff about migration, which doesn't really hit the news, but it might affect your workforce, your skills, demand for your product. If you're providing housing products or you're providing services directly to migrants, then that's something to keep a really close eye on. The ones that really affect small business too is retail spending. Doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's a massive, a lot of small businesses are in the retail space, either in retailing of food or product or clothing and the like, so, and manufacturing of those products. So keep an eye on retail spending. It's a really good indicator of how much money, literally, we're spending as households. And also inflation's a big one as well, because it gives you an idea of your cost. So there's a lot of focus at the moment on cost of living pressure. That's for households for sure, but there's also big costs for business. Things like transport, energy, petrol, insurance, all of that's in the CPI. And you're sort of shaking your head and nodding at the same time. It's like insurance costs are through the roof. The energy, we're sitting here with the lights on and the air conditioning going, the cost of that's gone through the roof. This is all important for your business. Of course, your top line is important, but your cost is really important as well, and your margin. So keep an eye on all that stuff. And if you can, get to know an economist. That would help too.
Date an economist. You're plugging the economist in the
dating scene. Your kids to do economics. I've got four kids. None of them did economics at university. No.
But just a moment. Your entire family, you were saying before, was journalists.
Journalists, yes.
And you're not a journalist.
I'm not a journalist, no. As you can tell.
So what was interesting about what you said there was that obviously economists can provide all this information, and it is available publicly in the papers. I imagine a lot of small businesses don't have time for that. But the ABS has this great service they provide where you can create your own persona, your own login, and keep an eye on, I believe that you can build out your own reporting. And although you're not producing, you know, these reports to be handed out to politicians, you are doing it for your business. And like you said, keeping an eye on those trends and looking what's happening in the economy as a whole and those macroeconomic features is something you can do on the ABS website. So not a lot of people know that. You can go in, you can build these reports, and then you can have them updated and you can keep an eye on those things. And just as you were speaking there, you know, you mentioned how people are part of retail. A lot of businesses are, if you're in a suburban area which is facilitating small business and retail, you might be a professional advisor, like an accountant or a bookkeeper. That's part of your flow as well. And I guess if we think of data as part of your supply chain and what moving parts of the supply chain you can keep an eye on, that's some really good advice.
That is a really good point, Alexi. And I would also suggest most people running a small business would have access to a bank. They probably have their customers of a bank or a financial institution. If you can, try to get access to the research put out by the economists of that bank.
Yes, that's
if you're
a good
able
idea.
To. Often it's for institutional clients, which they call, say, fund managers or pension funds. But if you can, see if you can get access to that economist's economic data, because what they do is they cut out all that analysis for you. Mm. They go to the ABS, as I used to do, look at that data, interpret it, give their own forecast or their own impression on it, and then publish it and write economic notes on it each day. Some of it can be a bit dense, but I think if you can get hold of, say, their daily reports, it gives you a great idea of what's going on. So That might be a challenge for some, but if you're able to contact your bank, you might get access to their economists' economic data and their write-ups.
And I know that NAB does their own quarterly small business impact. I can't remember what it's called. It's small business index.
They do. They do the big business survey and they do the small business survey.
And they do the small and medium, which is quite helpful as well. But ultimately, I think, and when we were unpacking that when I was an advocate, it doesn't really make it relatable for you as a small business owner. And I think that's what I like about the ABS stuff is that it's about you specifically and you can look at a certain area. You can actually go down as granular as a suburb and a postcode.
You can really curate it to your own needs. You really can.
That's... And if you can spend a little bit of time doing that, it will help you become that economist for your own business and become give you the ability to predict. Like you said, you can be a weatherman, an economic weatherman.
Indeed.
The other place that people can go to as well, which we're always a big advocate for here on Small Biz Matters, is checking in with your professional association, your industry association. They will take the data that's relevant for you, unpack it and make it make sense for your industry. And we know that membership fees can be expensive at times, but that doesn't mean you can't engage with them through newsletters and through information, follow them on socials, look at that data when it comes out. It can be a bit graphy. But have a look at it and discuss it with your peers. Maybe sit down and go, what does this mean for us? And how can we interpret it and make it make sense for our business? It is worth spending that time.
It really is. And look, I do the same thing, albeit for a different audience. But my team and myself, I've got five economists working for me, and we do exactly that.
For
the big end of town, indeed. Yep. So we look at what happened. So what's tomorrow's inflation data's out tomorrow. We'll look at that and say, was inflation going up or down? What were the components? Was it petrol? Mm. Was it insurance? Yes and yes. But
prediction.
And we will actually write up that and send it out to our members, albeit, as we've established, the big end of town. Mm. You can do the same for the smaller businesses. So there are bodies out there and there are others who do it, I wouldn't say for free, but they do it more cheaply than, say, the big banks do.
Yeah.
You can get access to this stuff through various channels.
Well, ABS data is all completely
ABS
free.
ABS does
totally.
It for free.
Yeah. And completely available. It's publicly available in a meaningful way.
And bear with it. It can be a little bit daunting when you first get in there, but the site is fantastic. I'm on a couple of panels that advise the ABS, so it's actually quite helpful, and I think they've come a mile in terms of what it used to be like. When I started as an economist, you would literally go down to the ABS physically and pick up a paper publication, write down the numbers on a piece of paper and go back to my desk at Treasury.
You weren't allowed to take them with you?
Nope.
Wow.
So that was
old school.
Late 1980s, I'm afraid to say. It's come miles from, and you had to pay for it as well.
Wow.
It's come miles. So you can actually get it all online. It's all free. It's all instant. Have a look.
And a big shout out to John Shepherd and Bjorn Jarvis, who do some amazing job with the labour statistics, which is obviously a very important statistic that small businesses should keep an eye on as well. As you mentioned, migration is a big one. Skilled migration is a big one. What's the breakdown happening per industry? Imports, exports, if you're involved in the food
industry. All there. Have a look around. Pretty much every moving part in the economy is on the ABS website. There are big gaps. As you said, Alexi, small business is one of them. They're closing it with this access to cards and data and bank data and supermarkets and the like. I understand there are still gaps
and problems. Trust issues.
Trust issues? Yeah.
I just don't think it's a true reflection. But I also understand that how does government, it's an eternal wicked problem, get the data without being, impactful and just constantly hounding small businesses to give them that information, which they may not even want to give in the first place.
No. And I am on a couple of committees, as I said, with the ABS who are trying to address this. So please reach out, and Lexi, you might want to do the same, reach out to these various committees or even to me, and let us know where the problems are, because we might be able to address this over time.
Mm. One of the things that I think is being successfully done is engagement on a more personal level. You mentioned how you did that at New South Wales Treasury. In your opinion, this is just your opinion, do you think government agencies and government itself and politicians are doing a good enough job of engaging with small businesses?
No.
Excellent. That was an easy
question.
Look,
I think access is one difficulty. And it's easy to reach out to the various representative groups, and there's where the big end, COSBOA is the smaller end, there are others. But I think you made the point earlier in your comments, Alexi, that small business is harder to access. And maybe because they're so busy. Again, I haven't run a small business, but I imagine if you're a small operation, you're still growing, you've started small, you're running frantically, you're doing your books at night.
You're not paying yourself.
You're reading the labour laws at night to make sure if you're going to employ someone, you're not going to trip on a landmine. it's very hard then to say, hey, I need to speak to my local MP at the same time.
Yeah.
Look, I'm not suggesting that's not insurmountable, but it's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, I think the answer is no, as being a bit flippant, of course.
But you're right. I mean, that is the difficulty. Even some agencies who represent small business have difficulty engaging with their smaller size, the micro and the smalls in particular, because like you said, they're growing and they're working so hard behind the scenes to keep their head above water.
Yeah.
And as the economy slows and becomes more problematic and more difficult, the ones who suffer the most are small businesses, the ones we don't hear from at all are small businesses because they're so busy just trying to keep their doors open and
Indeed.
Survive and hold on
Look,
to their
one thing
employees.
I've learned during my time with the Business Council is there's always submissions that you can make to government. Now, this is, again, it's a pretty big job to write a submission to government. So if government's going to change policy, they often call for submissions.
Well, it's not – I don't think – I would argue that. I mean, I know the Business Council and COSBOA and the bigger groups, they throw a lot of time and they're really
–
and they're very important. But that's not to say that if you are a small business and you go to a council meeting or you hear from another business that there's something major that's going to impact your business in locally – that you can't put in a submission. And it can be literally an email.
You can. It can be an email.
Exactly.
It can be a half page or it can be a verbal submission.
Case studies are
critical.
It
takes additional work, I get it. But if you think you're going to be affected by some government decision, major or minor, you can make a submission. So keep an eye on government websites. Again, it takes a little bit of detective work to work out which ones. But if you're in a certain industry, manufacturing, for example, you might want to keep an eye on the industry minister, Ed Husic, at the federal level and state equivalents, and work out what they're doing, what their policy process is, and if you're going to be affected, make a submission. As you say, it could be an email to the minister's office. That is a submission.
Now, what we talk a lot about, well, I don't talk a lot about it because I think there's a balancing act with red tape. But I wanted to ask you, what is where's the balance? How do you find the right amount of red tape to make sure that small businesses are still able to function without, as you said, tripping over a landmine, but at the same time keeping other people safe? What's the key to finding that balance between red tape or a completely free economy?
It's really hard. We can't have a completely free economy because you need rules and regulations. People do either illegal stuff or dumb stuff, and we need to make sure that doesn't happen. You need regulation. There's industries that clearly need regulation, whether it's providers of utilities or energy or the like, are heavily regulated. My observation over the last couple of years, and it's not just under this government but under the prior government, mainly at the federal level, is that the regulatory burden's got a lot heavier.
Absolutely.
A lot heavier. Not just with workplace relations, which is a key one, but there's things like cyber, there's privacy, there's environmental laws. All this is changing as well. So even when you get a regulatory burden, which we call it a burden because it is a burden to comply, particularly for smaller business that doesn't have a department for legal, regulation, compliance and the like, maybe not even HR. Most of them don't have an HR department.
Or even an HR advisor.
Indeed. So it is a challenge for small business, but I think the regulatory burden's got a lot heavier. We do need it, but you've got to find that balance between having effectively government running everything, which hasn't worked so well in the past, we've known that, and having a completely free economy that probably won't work either. Finding that balance in the middle, I reckon, is a lot of trial and error, and engage in that submissions process because that's how you can actually say to an elected representative, hey, you know what, this burden of what you're doing on cyber or privacy is affecting my small business and I can't comply for whatever reason, or I'm finding it difficult to understand what I need to do to comply and I don't want to break the law. That's really, really hard and it takes a long time. So I think it's back and forward. Speak to your local representatives, your councils, if you are a member of a representative body, speak to them. They're engaged with the government typically. Speak to other business groups because we're heavily engaged in this stuff, but certainly the regulatory burden's got really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And I should give you the context here. Other countries are doing the opposite. Other countries are making it easier to start a business, hire people. Environmental laws are pretty tough in most places, but again, some are easier than us, some are more difficult. I'm not saying you don't need them, but where the burden is easiest or lightest, you'll often see investment flow. Now, this is more a big end of town story. Most small businesses can't invest in the US or in Japan. Big business can, and capital will flow around the world where it's least restricted and where the investment returns are best. So if you make it harder to do business, capital will flow elsewhere.
So you make it harder for the big business because you're not getting that investment capital moving into the country. You make it harder for small business because they can't function and they're literally drowning in red tape.
Yep.
There was a point at which the government and a number of representative bodies were supportive of the idea of having a economic figure placed on every new regulatory policy suggestion. Does that even work?
It does. It's called a regulatory impact statement. Sounds like the most boring document in the world, and it is. But it's actually it's a law that if government's going to change policy, they need to put out a regulatory impact statement. Now, some of it's less formalised than we would like, and we're recommending as the Business Council that that be formalised in every single policy decision-making apparatus of government. So if government's going to make a decision on we're going to re-regulate the labour market, and that's what they're doing, they should put out what's called a RIS, regulatory impact statement, saying, well, here's what the impact is going to be. You're going to put an extra burden on business. You're going to add cost because you need to have more people in a business to comply with all these laws, whether it's privacy or cyber, for example. And that's a cost. That's going to cost business X million dollars a year in aggregate, and therefore you need to factor that into your decision-making. They're not functioning properly at the moment, these so-called RISs. Government needs to do a lot of work to look at them and say, this is a proper RIS rather than just we're ticking a box.
Yeah.
Saying we've done a RIS on this, an impact statement. They're not really taking it seriously, to be honest.
Do you think that those RISs should be publicly available?
They should be. Absolutely should be made.
Are they currently publicly available?
Some are and some aren't. We can find them because we know where to look. They're not easy to find. But you can really... journalists have as I said, I'm from a family mainly of journalists, but they have a great advantage of doing freedom of information searches, and you can find a lot of this stuff. Most of it is published, but some of them are not.
It's a great example of where the associations and the industry bodies can push the government, have the ear of government, and say this is where you're not meeting the requirements of a RIS, and we would like to push for that as well. So I see this as an opportunity for all of the business groups to come together and really start pushing this, because if there can be economic data, real cost, real jobs and real people at the back end of this who are suffering, and it can be shown on this statement, then surely that would encourage the government not to push so hard in certain ways.
You would hope so. They're really powerful documents if done properly. The key phrase is if done properly.
Indeed. Well, look, Stephen, I wanted to thank you so much for coming on the program today. Where can people find out about the great work that you do in the Business Council of Australia?
Oh, so on our website. So there's obviously we have a website, bca.com.au. You might even find some of my work on there. It's free. It's all sitting there. Have a look. And very pleased to be here, and very, very happy to keep talking about small business as well as big business, because we're all in this together.
Indeed. And if you've missed any of today's program, you can, of course, catch up via our website, radio.smallbizmatters.com.au, and also via LinkedIn and Facebook or wherever you get your podcasts. We're going to come back after this short break and find out who's on the program next week. We've got a great lineup of guests, so stay with us. We'll be back after this.
This episode of Small Biz Matters is proudly sponsored by the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman's Office. As SBFEO assists, advocates and provides information to Australia's 2.5 million small and family businesses when and where they need it. SBFEO delivers practical and actionable advice and research to governments on how to improve policies and legislation. Since its inception, SBFEO has responded to over 40,000 requests for assistance from Australian small and family businesses, and provides access to dispute resolution services, including assistance with disputes that fall under the franchising, dairy, horticulture, and oil codes. SBFEO also connects small and family business with mental health support should the need arise. As an independent advocate for small business owners, SBFEO is committed to ensuring that Australia is the best place to start, grow or transform a business now and well into the future. See how SBFEO can support you at asbfeo.gov.au.
And welcome back to Triple H 100.1 FM. Let's find out who's coming on Small Biz Matters People Policy Purpose next week. We've got Emma Clark, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Mabel. And this is all about the impact that big tech is having on the role of being an advocate on behalf of small businesses' users. Do they really represent small business voice, or are they really just looking after the interest of their company? When we think about Mabel, they are a provider for a platform for which NDIS providers can list their services, can engage with other providers, and also get educated and find out about how to run a small business. But the question is, how much is a platform like that going to impact policy decisions around things like NDIS and contractor versus employee and other workplace relations issues? So it's an important question to be asking, and we're very excited to have the Chief Operating Officer of Mabel. Of course, it's also a very interesting company to see how a tech company like that has grown and tapped into big policy changes around NDIS to be a success. And that's something else we'll be talking about as well. So join us this week on Triple H 100.1 FM, and I will see you all then.